Imagine it's June 17th, 1994, and it started off as a normal day for you. You're a part-time college student in Ames, Iowa, and you're working as a delivery driver for Domino's Pizza. You had no plans to work that evening. Instead, you were just going to watch the NBA Finals matchup between the New York Knicks and the Houston Rockets. However, your evening plans are suddenly disrupted with an urgent call from your manager. You need to come in now. Frustrated but wanting to keep your job, you hop into your Pontiac Grand Am, pop in your Nirvana cassette tape, and drive the short distance to the store, where you're immediately handed a stack of pizzas to deliver. In fact, all of the drivers have been called into work. It's crazy. Unlike anything you've ever seen. Busier than the Super Bowl, certainly busier than any random June Friday. What could have possibly caused this peak in sales on a random Friday? It turns out, a few hours before, a former NFL legend turned actor decided to take a ride with a friend. But this wasn't just any ride. For the past few months, the world had been enthralled by the criminal investigation into the murder of football legend O.J. Simpson's ex-wife, with many believing that the juice was responsible. On June 17th, O.J. suspiciously hopped into a white Bronco with his friend Al Cowlings, and when spotted on the highway, the incident prompted an all-out police chase across Southern California. TV news was immediately all over the incident, with helicopter cameras following every move of the white Bronco. People across the world were glued to their televisions. But it was almost dinner time. And no one wanted to break their attention for a second, because unlike in today's let's just pause it and pick it up later world, everything happened live. So what did they do? Well, they ordered a pizza. And who could deliver that pizza in 30 minutes or less, or else it's free? Well, Domino's, of course. Thus, June 17th, 1994 became the biggest sales night in the history of Domino's Pizza. News reports showed employees lamenting, "Oh man, this is crazy, we just ran out of cheese." And as crazy as it was for the delivery crew, imagine what it must have felt like for Domino's marketing team. Think of all the things they'd done to try to boost pizza sales prior to June 17th. Ad campaigns, celebrity partnerships, coupon offers, billboards, radio spots. They even created the Noid for pizza's sake, just to try and move more pies. But nothing, nothing worked anywhere near as well as a wanted man in a white Bronco. An unfortunate event over which they had zero control. Dumb luck and timing. Today kicks off a new series on ideas, because ideas are the lifeblood of your career. But where do they come from? How exactly do they work? How do you know when they're right? And is there anything you can do to control when and how you have them? Or is it all just dumb luck and timing? So stick around and maybe order a pizza, because we're about to do a 4-week dive into how to spark brilliance in your life and your work. This is Daily Creative, and I'm Todd Henry. Welcome to the show. John Muir once wrote, "When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe."
I've long sort of felt uneasy with some of the basic assumptions about how the world works. And the more that I looked into them, the more that I thought a lot of them were wrong. And so I tried to write a book that said that.
That's Brian Kloss. And the book he's referring to is his new book called Fluke, in which he argues that so many of the things we experience in our life are less the result of some organized strategic plan and more the result of a complicated web of contingencies.
I'm a political scientist by trade, but also, you know, just navigating modern life. I think that John Muir quote is referring to something that is a basic fact of reality, and that's why it spoke to me so much. All the sort of stuff that we get thrown at us is like, here's just what you need to do to succeed, or here's the way that you can avoid a recession, you know, with these five variables, and you tweak monetary policy and everything's fine. And I don't think the world is quite so straightforward. I think that there is a lot more chance and randomness that plays a role, and contingency, where things could have turned out differently. And the way that you end up in that space is by understanding that there are ripple effects to every single thing that we do, which is where the interconnection comes in.
So creativity is pattern forming. As Steve Jobs once said, creativity is just connecting dots. But Brian believes that one of the reasons we struggle is that we overconnect, that we find too many patterns, sometimes patterns where there aren't even patterns to be found.
Our minds evolved to find patterns because it helped us survive. I mean, it's basically that simple, right? So, you know, if you hear a rustling of grass in the hunter-gatherer period of human history and you discount it and you don't think maybe there's a saber-toothed tiger there, you might die, right? So if there is a saber-toothed tiger, you start to learn very quickly, okay, run away when you hear this noise. Now, sometimes there's nothing there. And if you run away when there's nothing there and it is just the wind, that's okay, you still survive. But if the opposite happens, right, and you don't run away when there is a saber-toothed tiger, you will die. So basically our brains have evolved through survival mechanisms to overinterpret patterns, right? It's better to see a pattern where there is none than to not see a pattern when there actually is one lurking in the weeds, as it were.
This overinterpretation of patterns is what causes many people to latch onto an idea too early in the process and then become fixated on it. They suddenly can't see any alternative because the pattern just matches up so perfectly. This is what I call the danger of the first idea. The ideas we have first can be very dangerous to our process because they create a sort of blindness. I was talking with my producer Josh about this, and it's something he battles in the strategy work he does with clients all the time. Over the years, he's learned to take aggressive steps to keep it in check.
Yeah, I mean, they're asking me to help like simplify their message and, you know, clarify their story. And that's what I'm going to do. But inevitably, there always comes this point before we get started where they want to know if they can send me over their materials, you know, decks and pre-reads and all of this sort of stuff. And I always tell them, absolutely not. I want to see and know as little as possible. I don't want your decks. I don't even want to look at your website. In fact, I go through great lengths to not look at any of their materials, not because I'm lazy. It's because I know that as soon as I see those things, it's as though I'm seeing like their first idea. There's a pattern that's represented there. And as soon as I see that, it's going to make it really difficult for me to see the alternatives. It creates that sort of blindedness that really doesn't help me come back to them with a new, better, clearer way of framing up their brand message and story so that it's really clear and anybody can understand it.
Maybe to put it in another way, the problem with first ideas is that once you see them, it's almost impossible to unsee them. And unfortunately, they can have a tendency to eclipse a lot of other more interesting ideas, leading you to miss less obvious connections, the ones that strike of brilliance. You've closed your mind and placed your bets on the first big idea that came along, and then set about convincing yourself as to why it was perfect. Brian says that the key to overcoming this temptation to put all of your chips on one big idea is to instead place a lot of little bets. But how? I mean, you have to start somewhere, right? In order to spin up a bunch of little bets, experiments as he calls them, you have to have a first bet. Isn't it the first idea that makes it so difficult to come up with the second, fifth, and 12th idea? So how do you get started without getting sabotaged?
One study, people were forced to find a different way to work because the subway, the tube in London, the drivers went on strike. And what these economists found was that 5% of the people affected actually kept the alternative pathway to work that they were forced into by the strike, and it was better for them. And they had no idea, right? They had lived according to the way they thought was best. They were shocked into experimentation, and they turned into a better route for them.
What Brian is describing is a strategy for overcoming the danger of the first idea. You have to turn it into a non-option. Force yourself to reject it. You couldn't use that idea even if you wanted to. It's off the table. So what's another? This forced deprivation can help you spot new ideas, new experiments that otherwise would have been overlooked. But first ideas aren't the only stumbling block we have to look out for as we reach for brilliance. Equally as dangerous are past ideas. It's hard to deny that consciously or subconsciously we judge new ideas by comparing them to old ones. We see an idea and think, yeah, that's kind of like that other thing, and it was a huge success, so this must be a good idea too. Or conversely, we've seen something like that before and it didn't work, this idea is a dud too. But that's a dangerous mistake.
When we think about success and failure, there's a massive bias there because, of course, the survivors, the people who do really well, are the ones we hear from. We don't hear from the ones who fail. And like my favorite example of this about how we tend to audit outcomes. We don't tend to audit processes. So like the Challenger shuttle that blew up in 1986, it had the same problem in all of the previous launches, but it didn't cause the explosion of the shuttle. So they didn't investigate it. They just figured, oh, it's fine. And then when it blew up, it's like, oh, we need an inquiry. And it's like all of those other launches that you thought were successes were actually failures. They just happened to get lucky that it didn't blow up because it wasn't cold enough. And if it had been slightly colder, it would have blown up earlier. So the whole idea here, I think, is one where when you start to ascribe causality in a neat and tidy line between X and Y, and you write out the flukes and the luck, you misunderstand how the world actually works, and that causes you to make mistakes.
Part of what makes past ideas poor measuring sticks is that we distort our view of them based upon whatever is most convenient or what makes us look best.
We sort of learn backwards, where we have, you know, an outcome, and then we sort of have this neat and tidy path. Oh, if we just do that again, it will be fine. And it's a serious, serious cognitive mistake, in my view.
There's a paradox that lies at the heart of Klaus's ideology.
You're less in control than you think you are, which is at first scary, except for the flip side of that is that everything that we do is important because the ripple effects of an interconnected world are enormous.
At first blush, the thought of having no real control feels like powerlessness. Yet Brian argues the opposite. Because of the infinite connectivity of the world and the potential ripple effects from every action we take, we are far more influential than we realize. Perhaps that's the reframe we need. It's less about control and more about influence. We can't eradicate chance from our work, but we can increase our chances of doing brilliant work.
Experiments in ways that cross traditional boundaries. All the smartest ideas I think I've ever come up with in my life have come from reading in fields that are not my own. When I think about my own creativity and my own process of writing Fluke and so on, you know, I read exclusively political science for a very long time because I'm a political scientist by trade. And then I started reading like physics, evolutionary biology, philosophy, a lot more history. And all of a sudden, it was like my politics ideas were getting smarter because I was getting insights that had never occurred to me from people who think totally differently from me. And so that experimentation combined with the sort of aspects of trying new things and not simply trying to follow the pathway that was forged previously is a very wise one.
Tipping the scales in your favor, or increasing the chances that brilliance will strike at a moment's notice, often comes down to how much time you spend crossing boundaries and exploring worlds and fields other than your own. If creativity is connecting dots, the more distance between the dots, the more profound the connections.
And the other thing, there's what's sometimes called a leisure time invention. There's loads of people who have invented incredible ideas when they have not been trying to. And I think this is something else that is important, is that you have to give yourself space to wander a little bit with intellectual ideas and concepts and not simply, you know, sit in front of a computer 10 hours a day and hope that lightning strikes and it comes to you. The Wright brothers came up with the idea for their airplane when they were watching buzzards during a picnic. Galileo came up with some ideas while he was, you know, looking at a chandelier actually swinging from a cathedral. So, I mean, there's like loads of these examples. I think the main point here is that when you think that the world operates according to very strict rules and laws and has this sort of neat and tidy reality, then you think you can control everything and you therefore optimize based on past experience, right? So you just try to squeeze every ounce of efficiency and do what was already done before a little bit better. When you accept uncertainty and you accept that there's a lot of, you know, random chance, arbitrariness, you know, flukes basically, you will optimize slightly less and experiment slightly more. And so I think this is why, like, for me, the philosophy is not dissociated from the life advice. If you think about the way the world works slightly differently, it will cause you to behave in different ways simply because it makes more rational sense. And I think some of the problems we have in modern society, by the way, all the shocks that we have of, you know, constant meltdowns and wars and pandemics and so on, is partly because we've over-optimized and under-experimented.
Brian Klaus's new book is called Fluke, and it's available now wherever books are sold. So remember that John Muir quote from a moment ago? When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything in the universe. The world is interconnected far beyond our control, which means it's impossible to know with certainty all the unintended consequences of our actions, sometimes referred to as luck. I came across something a number of years ago. I can't remember the book or the author. If you know the reference, drop me a line. I'd love to give credit where credit's due. But it goes something like this. Imagine you're sitting in your office, and all around you are the trappings of your day-to-day work life. Perhaps a book on the shelf, or equipment on the walls, stacks of paper, computer screens, a keyboard, pens, pencils, paper clips, swivel chair, family photos, and a frame on your desk. Picture it all. Now, picture a string attached from one item to another, to another, to another, in a complex web so intricate you can't fully comprehend the extent of the interconnectedness you find yourself immersed in. Suddenly, the phone rings. And this is where it gets interesting. You reach to answer, pull the handset to your ear, and suddenly discover that it was tied to the book on the shelf, which was tied to the family photo on your desk, which was tied to the light switch near the door. So you answer the call, and around you, chaos ensues. The book is pulled from its perch, which topples the photo, which flips the light switch, and engulfs you in midday darkness. You stand up to flip the light back on, and the sliding chair tugs on the paper clips, which yank your keyboard to the floor at your feet, and it goes on and on and on. Every move you make is marked by a chaotic and unpredictable chain reaction, all because everything is connected to everything. Klaus's argument is that since we simply can't know the full extent and nature of each and every connection, the best thing to do is to make as many moves as possible, as many little experiments as he calls them, so you can observe as many possible outcomes as you can. Then choose from that broader set of options. Perhaps this is the theory under the old axiom, the harder I work, the luckier I get. Simply put, interconnectivity creates unpredictability, meaning the world is so interconnected we literally can't predict what will happen next. So the best next thing we can do is experiment and react. In some ways, you could say fight randomness with randomness. But if that's true, what does that mean for those of us who design for a living? If everything is chaos, randomness, and dumb luck, then how can any of us have confidence that we're crafting a solution that will actually work? Klaus's argument that the interconnectivity of the universe makes us infinitely more influential than we realize is only half good news. Because the other half is, you'll never quite know the outcome. In other words, you're infinitely capable, but chronically insecure. And if you're in the idea business, that's a horrible company slogan.
I'm Diane Hoskins, current title, co-CEO of Gensler.
My name is Andy Cohen. I'm co-CEO of Gensler with Diane.
Diane and Andy are the co-CEOs of the world's largest architecture and design firm, Gensler. They and their team design and build some of the largest and most impactful structures on the planet, things like airport terminals and sports arenas, as well as office buildings and parks. If anyone understands the difficult realities of the complex interconnectedness of the world, it's the team at Gensler. They have 55 offices scattered across 17 countries. They also understand that fighting randomness with randomness is no way to run a design firm. But that doesn't mean that they deny the reality that our world is profoundly interconnected. In fact, quite the opposite.
You know, we're living in a time of radical change. We're facing wave after wave of compounding crisis, from the pandemic to climate change to economic volatility to geopolitical instability to social injustice. And look at what's happening today in Ukraine and the Middle East. The crises we face today are interconnected.
See, there's also a dark side to interconnectedness. It's not just all the good stuff that's tied together with a string. It's the bad stuff, too. The crises we face don't exist in a silo. They're connected to every other crisis in some way. Pull on climate change and geopolitical instability falls off the shelf, which tugs at social injustice and so on. One crisis multiplies into the others.
We coined the term the crisis multiplier. They're layered, they're converging, and they're accelerating, and they're requiring broad, big idea designs to move forward.
You know, we really believe that design is core to creating a better world. And that's really what we're talking about in the book.
The idea for Diane and Andy's new book, Design for a Radically Changing World, was born in the back of a taxi while driving through the streets of Japan together. They were in the midst of a world tour of sorts, visiting the various Gensler offices and observing the impact their firm was having in cities across the globe.
But we really want to help people understand that design is essential to solve the kinds of issues that we're talking about. When we're looking at the housing crisis, every single country is dealing with this issue of housing and a shortage of housing. When we're dealing with what's happening with the climate and the role of the built environment design in dealing with the climate crisis, when we're talking about bringing people together and finding common ground, you can do that through design.
As a firm, Gensler starts where any design firm starts. How can we craft an elegant solution? But where they may differ from many firms is by reframing the purpose of their work in light of the deep interconnectedness of the many crises we face today. Ask the average architecture firm what they do, and they'll likely say some fancy version of "we design buildings." But that's a siloed way of looking at your work. At Gensler, they would likely say something more like, "we use architectural design to help address some of the world's biggest problems." Just as one example.
Controlling carbon is an essential part of reducing temperature and slowing down climate change. Most people wouldn't say that the built environment is a big part of that. Well, as it turns out, the built environment accounts for 40% of global emissions. It's the largest chunk that you can define around any single ecosystem. Concrete alone accounts for 10% of all of global emissions. And already we know that there's a couple of companies that have created a zero emissions concrete. If we can partner with them to scale the use of that product, we could literally have one of the largest impacts of any single action that one could take in terms of the reduction of greenhouse gases.
As a designer, your work has massive potential, not in spite of the interconnectedness of crises, but because of it. Use interconnectivity to your advantage, and your ideas will have much greater impact. And at Gensler, there are two strategies in particular that they use to help random-proof their ideas. The first is...
Our whole philosophy around collaborative leadership, it's a very, very flat organization. In most cases, we have two or three leaders in every single leadership part of the firm. Mm. Starting at the top with Diane and I, everyone has aces and spaces. Things you're great at and not so great at. But we take two phenomenal leaders that come from two different points of view, and you put them together, that's when innovation happens. And I really believe that's what's driven our firm forward with this idea of 1 + 1 = 5. In every one of our offices, our practice areas, every area in our firm is led through collaborative leadership.
We believe very strongly that it's when you bring different together that you get creativity. That difference is important, and the energy that comes from people who are different coming together with a common purpose and vision to really deconstruct and reconstruct what's possible in the world.
So plenty of firms and agencies will talk a good game about the importance of collaboration, but Diane and Andy are putting their money where their mouths are, wiring difference into their organization. Because with every different perspective, they multiply their ability to anticipate unintended consequences that narrow viewpoints they simply can't foresee. They smoke out bad luck before it's too late. The second strategy is also part of what makes Gensler unique.
This is something we talk about in the book, engaging in that very direct, intimate, local level. What are the specifics? What are the needs? Having empathy and engaging with users as well as the community, but also bringing global knowledge, knowledge we've learned from having worked in over 100 different countries.
We have 6,000 clients a year that we work with around the globe, and like Diane said, in over 100 countries. So we really believe that the global perspective is really important. We do global research. We have what's called the Gensler Research Institute that does a lot of research on all the latest trends that are happening around the globe. Yet we bring that locally to our clients. You know, it's interesting. These are global problems you're dealing with, like climate change or cities or human health. And there are no borders. So we take great pride in that because we're a global firm. We can have that global perspective and yet be local with our clients and bring that knowledge specifically to every project.
Local informs global, which informs local. It's tempting to favor one over the other, but Gensler rejects the idea that you have to choose. Everything is connected, so finding ways to hold a zoomed-in view while simultaneously holding a zoomed-out view will give you the greatest insight. No one knows the woods better than the one who can see the forest and the trees. Designing from a dual perspective will inevitably lead to the greatest possible impact. And impact is what we're all striving for, isn't it?
You are a designer. Every design starts with an idea and with a what if. To realize as you're walking down the street, wow, if this sidewalk was wider, or, you know, we do need to find a place for those scooters, or if we had more trees, or where could we put a community place, and how different this community would be if there were some places for us to come together. You know, let your mind and your imagination begin to have those kinds of questions, and you will be, you know, part of creating a better world.
So we've covered a lot of ground today, but let's summarize some of what we've discussed. Both Brian Kloss and the team at Gensler were talking about the same idea, how we contend with the deep interconnectedness of the world we live in, but they were offering slightly different approaches. Brian Kloss suggested that we experiment as much as possible, that we cross boundaries, that we capitalize on downtime, and that we don't over-optimize. Diane and Andy from Gensler suggested that we use interconnectedness to our advantage since crises are connected to one another, and that we force difference into the equation so that we can see things from different perspectives and use that conflict to help get to the best idea, and that we combine local and global vantage points so that we're not just thinking about specifics, but we're also seeing the larger patterns. All of these strategies are ones that we can apply in our life as creative pros to help deal with the interconnectedness that we experience and the effects of what we might otherwise describe as luck. Throughout the rest of this series, we're going to explore where ideas come from and how we can have more of them and what we should do with them when we have them. If you'd like to hear the full interviews with Brian Kloss, Diane Hoskins, and Andy Cohen, you can do so in the Daily Creative app. There you'll also find daily podcast episodes, prompts to help you be brave, focused, and brilliant, courses, and the entire podcast archives dating back many years. You can subscribe at dailycreative.app. Daily Creative is produced by Joshua Gott. My name is Todd Henry. Thank you for listening.